following is a presentation of Foosball Radio. It's Foos Talk Live.
Are you talking to me?
Compelling and lively banter.
Are you going to talk to us?
Talking foosball.
Foosball was how I measured my value as a man. You took that away.
Players and fans, promoters and pros. Unedited and raw.
Talk, talk, talk.
Living in the moment.
We have a lot of important things to talk about.
All while practicing social distancing.
Cool. We'll talk. No big whoop.
Let's get this thing started. Foos Talk Live.
Hi there, this is Tom Robinson, and I want to personally thank our Patreon pillars for their support of Foosball Radio and Foos Talk Live. Here's to our newest member, Thomas Dyke, Mike Veit, Rob Cutler, Ernie Bischoff, Alicia Bilges, James Sparky Castillo, Christina Fuchs, Carl Fleischer, Jay Teal, Brian Schmid, Cameron Burrows, Jimmy Love, Dwayne Stewart, Judy Schober, Reed Rector, and our friends from the 716 Buffalo Foosball Club. Thank you. Your continued support brings expanding content from Foosball Radio as we cover the greatest sport on earth. Visit patreon.com/foosballradio to find out how to become a Foosball Radio Patreon. Foos Talk Live is brought to you by Original Leonhardt. The Leonhardt Tournament Model is the most popular foosball table at the ITSF World Cup. Designed and handcrafted in Germany. Order online and have it delivered to your door. Visit www.original-leonhardt-usa.com and use promo code FOOSTALK to save 10% off your purchase price. Yes, it's episode 200 of Foos Talk Live. Hey there, I'm Tom Robinson. I want to wish you a very happy St. Paddy's Day. Hope you're enjoying the holiday. It's official. We have now been gathering each week to do a live chat about foosball since April of 2020. And tonight, we mark our 200th episode. Now, before we get started here, I wanted to take a moment to thank you, the listener and viewer, by the way, of Twitch TV. When Jim Stevens and I first decided to do this, Foosball Radio had been a podcast for about 2 years. The COVID pandemic hit and shut down everything, including major tournaments and regional tournaments and, of course, the local foosball scene. So since we were stuck inside, Jim and I decided the best thing to do about this whole situation was to start talking about foosball live every week with Foos Talk Live. And that's basically how this all came about. Yes, we've experienced some growing pains along the way. Need I mention the Foos Talk Live mystery guest? Yeah, okay. So we made some mistakes along the way, but we learned from our mistakes. And hopefully this show has become, well, something that you can depend upon for entertainment and some information about foosball. Now, no one, least of all me, could do this alone. That's why I'll always be eternally grateful for my original Foosball Radio hosts, Nino Dijon and Chuck Dooley. Eric Cicino also was our guru when it came to the technology and made all of this possible. Once Foos Talk Live was born, Jim Stevens, Clay Toomey, Mark Torres, and Adam Gilson brought their extensive knowledge to the show. They even tolerated my terrible jokes and my obvious lack of knowledge of the sport of foosball. More recently, I've been very blessed and been able to work with other great talent, including Hannah D. Smith, Mike Green, Alan Montrone, and more recently, Randy Raposo, who, by the way, Randy, got to give you a shout out for your performance this weekend at Mississippi Open. Yes, you won open doubles with Brandon Munoz. Nice going, man. Can't wait to hear about it next week. Well, since Randy's on the road this weekend, I thought it would be great to celebrate our 200th episode and feature one of the great legends of foosball. Known not just for his playing, but he's a longtime promoter who also ran TornadoFoosball.com, that website. Now, if you were a promoter at one time and needed anything for your tournament, Charles was the man to go to. Now, he's now retired and playing golf on a regular basis. He always was someone you could rely upon in foosball, in the sport of foosball. So sit back and relax, enjoy your St. Paddy's Day celebration, and listen in as Foos Talk Live features Charles McIntosh.
Hey there, it's Tom Robinson, episode number 200 of Foos Talk Live. And we are celebrating today with a Hall of Famer, a name that everybody knows in the sport of foosball, quite a history, in fact. From the great state of North Carolina, it's Charles McIntosh. Hello, Charles.
Hey, Tom. How are you today?
I am well. I trust you're getting ready to get out on the golf course today. Is that true?
Yeah, that's about right. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Must be nice to be able to play golf in March, or for that matter, you know, any time of the year. So, first of all, welcome to the show. This is the 200th episode. I thought perhaps it would be a great idea to have someone like yourself on, being a Hall of Famer, and of course a legendary player and promoter, and of course, the owner of TornadoFoosball.com, which we remember so well. Providing tables and parts and all the things that people need to play the sport properly. So, do you miss being in the sport?
I guess somewhat. I really enjoyed what I did for a living,
mm-hmm.
and for me, it was a game. It turned into a sport. It
mm-hmm.
turned into a part-time business in college. And then being full time, and I actually never saw myself having a career in it, but I learned early on that if I wanted to stay involved in foosball and play at a high level, I needed to do it for a living.
Yeah.
And that's what I chose to do, and it worked out pretty well. And, of course, in the later years, I became, the promoter and everything else that we did all through our career. But then we founded TornadoFoosball.com.
Mm-hmm.
It was a good run with that one. Helped a lot of folks all over the country, and saw it then and participated in, provided tables for an awful lot of tournaments throughout the year. So,
it's been a great
run, and I miss parts of it. But you know what? It was time for me to walk away, and I really enjoy retirement life. I'm telling you what, play golf four or five times a week
mm-hmm.
in the summertime, two or three in the winter, and year round just like foosball, but never got to participate in any of the winter action while I was a player.
Right.
Doing that now.
Yeah. Well, I think it's only fair if we begin at the beginning. So, traditionally on this show, whenever we have a player on, a promoter, we like to find out about your origins. So give us an idea. When was the first time you saw a foosball table? How old were you? And what kind of table was it?
Well, I was about probably around 14 years old.
Okay.
My next door neighbor, a guy named Boyd Gallimore, opened a game room 3 miles from our house, and he had a son who was a few years younger than me, but we were close friends and play buddies, his children.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he opened his game room, of course, they had pool tables, and one day they got a foosball table in there, and another time I remember very specifically watching these guys who obviously had been playing foosball for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually saw a guy, do a push shot, and the ball disappeared. And I thought to myself, I'm going to have to learn how to do that. I wonder what he did. And so I talked with him a little bit, and, began to figure it out at that point. Started playing on German, that was a German table, the Deutschmeister. And then, yes, sir. And then later, throughout the next couple, 3 years before I would go in the Air Force after high school, we played in different cities, different tables.
Mm-hmm.
We went to Greensboro, went to Winston-Salem. We went into the Bonvini, well, not the Bonvini, the Rene Pierre, which was its predecessor in the U.S.
Right.
And we played the French tables. And, of course, we'd play the German tables when we were – we had one right across from our middle school and our high school that we would go play at. A guy, it wasn't my place, but it was called Charlie's Grocery.
Mm-hmm.
And, Charlie had a table in the back room. And You know, we play there during, middle, after school, that sort of thing.
Okay.
But that's where it all started. You know, played a few years, ran into a couple other tables, you know, Garlando, you know, here locally in North Carolina before heading off to Texas. And well, of course, in Texas is where I discovered, you know, both Dynamo, tournament soccer, and Tornado.
Right.
And that's where the dream began.
And so your career as a competitive player, when was the first time you went to a major tournament, and how did you do that day?
Okay. Well, you know, that's an interesting question, because there's a couple answers to it. Number one, the first tournament I ever played in was the school championship. Well, actually, it was local tournaments in the San Antonio area.
Okay.
There weren't many. Most of the tournaments were, you know, just people putting quarters on the table and seeing how long you could hold the table. Tiffany Billiards is an old haunt. I don't think it's still there anymore in San Antonio, but okay. It's where everybody played at that time, in the quarter house. That's where I met Steve Simon for the first time in 77, the same year that he won. I believe he won both TS and Tornado Nationals that year, singles. But in any case, you know, in San Antonio, rather in those years, you know, of course, we were just moving, playing everywhere we could.
Mm-hmm.
But the first tournament I ever remember of a major event was our school championship at the University of Texas, San Antonio. And my partner, Chip Lander, and I managed to win that against a couple of A3S players and, you know, everybody else that showed up. But that was the first one of those. But in, and, of course, my state championship in 83 here in North Carolina, a $500 tournament.
Okay.
Was the first big tournament I ever actually ran. And then the first major tournament probably was maybe an Atlanta tournament, Texas State.
Mm-hmm.
Probably in 83, 85, you know, because I was, at that point, I was involved with Tornado and Ed McLeod, and we were beginning to bring foosball back from the debacle of 81 on tournament soccer.
Yes.
And so we were really working pretty hard to get tables to anybody that was willing to run a tournament, whether they're in Florida or Colorado or whatever. And so, but in terms of my first major tournament as in world championships, that would be the 83 Tornado Worlds. I actually took fifth place
mm-hmm.
in expert doubles with Barry Doe, who was my roommate at the time. And so that was that. Then, of course, Tornado skipped a year and had the next day championships, next world championships in 85, and that was in Oklahoma City. And that one was the first one I ever officiated,
mm-hmm.
a world finals match. It was open doubles. So
okay.
My officiating career, you know, pretty much started on tour at that point, which I'm pretty proud of, my officiating career, because we started the official certification program, started
nice.
Running, you know, different educational seminars at tournaments to train officials. So
yeah, that's
all that happened in the early 80s.
Yeah, it's interesting in the sense that you've covered just about every aspect of this sport, whether it being a player, a promoter, a supplier of tables, and an official. So, is there anybody else in the sport that has that kind of pedigree?
No, not really. there are a few others that have. You know, back in the day, if you were a promoter, you weren't very well respected as a player.
Okay.
And, you know, I really tried hard to overcome that, because I love playing, I'm a very competitive person.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had a goal to win a world title. And so that was what was motivating me in the 80s, as well as loving the game and wanting to see it prosper and, you know, doing everything I could to make a living at the sport I love.
Right. Yeah. No, it's the history of this sport is really vast. And I think especially because of your background, there's a few people like yourself left who can really kind of tell us the story. Now, of course, the movie Foosballers had a bit of you in it. And what was that? What was it like? What was it like to be interviewed for that movie?
Well, you know, it was interesting. I got a call from the fellow who was the project manager with that, and he talked to me a while, just like you are.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, he decided to send a crew over here, and so they came here, to our shop, and we talked with them for a while, and took them out, showed them a few things, and had dinner with them, and it was a really wonderful experience. And I had no idea what they were going to do.
Yeah,
they took a lot of footage, and then I saw a few snippets show up in the movie, and I was real proud of that. So,
yeah,
A little further in the cap, if you will, but I thought they did a great job with that for a foosball movie.
Oh yeah, no, it's one of my favorites, and I think every time I watch it, I see something different in mm-hmm. that film. It just it really tells the story beautifully. So
it's the first movie I've ever seen. Yeah. Every person in the movie.
Yeah, right. Exactly. No, it's exciting. Joe Heslinger, who's the executive producer and basically the writer mm-hmm. behind that. What a wonderful storyteller. And we're hoping that he hopefully steps out again and does another one. I know he wants to do something about the international scene. Speaking of international, what's your experience when it comes to things like the World Cup?
Well, I went three times as a player. Mm-hmm. I was a senior at that point. It was interesting that early in my career, I achieved my goal in foosball, and of course, doing foosball in the interim period when I became a senior, boy, it was like a new lease on life.
Yes. Of
course, the roster in the senior events is a little thinner, and the competition is not quite as it's still stiff. Because all players like myself are always aging up, and every year you get a new crop of competition. But it was nice. I actually I won the Kentucky State, the first Kentucky State senior event, which didn't have many teams at all.
Okay.
Got to go to the World Cup three times. I qualified with Bruce Nardosi, and
yes.
he actually ended up being on the not on the senior team that time. He was actually on the men's team because of his Bonzini experience.
Right.
But I was the team captain the first year, and then we took silver medal. We lost to the Germans. The next year, we missed qualifying by a single point.
Oh.
And then the final year, we took second place to the Netherlands.
Okay.
So, we didn't ever get the gold, but got a couple of silver medals. And I always thought that was quite poetic. Because the first half of my career, most of my money came in the form of cash in a cash box.
Okay.
Silver quarters.
Yeah, yeah. Understood.
I'm pretty good at getting second place, but I had a few wins, but boy, I had a lot of second places.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, so the European system, I mean, it's certainly different, from the way we look things in America. And there is soon to come something called the World Series. The ITSF World Series is happening in Dallas, Texas, Memorial Day weekend. Have you heard about that? And what do you think about the ITSF bringing their system to America?
I have mixed emotions about it.
Mm.
Quite frankly, I think it's a good thing. I know Fareed. I know him well.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand Fareed's motivation. And, of course, expanding the sport is never a bad thing. I think it comes with growing pains. It's hard to stomach a little bit for a lot of people. Me, I don't have a dog in the hunt anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard for a lot of people to stomach the Texas State's being displaced by a tournament which, really, I have not looked at the payouts, but the ITSF is famous for not paying out much money.
Right.
And that is those rubs against the grain of American football players, because whether you're playing in the DYP or whether you're playing in the World Championship, you expect to get paid.
Yes.
And you may not be paid a lot of money, but you might get gas money at least in the DYP and your venture feedback. And at World Championships, maybe you can pay for some of your expenses in the lower events.
Yes.
But in the upper events, I mean, you know, Tony Spears is really truly one of the only, him and Todd are only two of the people that have ever really made a career in playing foosball for a living.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, there's, and that's sad, because if we're ever going to make it as a pro sport, it's got to have incentive to have the best players there.
Right.
And that is only, that incentive is only green. You know, yeah. Fame is not going to get, it's not going to rule the day. And so, and that's why, you know, one of the reasons Tony moved overseas was to participate in that and sponsorship and that sort of thing.
Yeah. But now,
I think it has some good aspects and, you know, but it is, it's going to have growing pains and mm-hmm. it'll have some pushback from American players. And I understand that, but, you know, things change.
Yeah.
And if it makes this sport a bigger sport internationally, then other things can come. And, you know, we've had an awful lot of problems in foosball, and it's good to see that somebody is working to solve a few of them. And
yes.
So I hope it works out. No guarantee it will. I don't know how much it will affect local promotions in the short term, but probably will in the long term.
Yeah. Yep. I think there's, you know, the fact that people are, like you say, are trying to do the right thing and figure out a way to make foosball much more of a sport. I know that with the ITSF flyer, they're requiring players to dress the part. You've got to wear a certain kind of clothing, collared shirts, and your team logo has to be on the shirt. So they've got some pretty strict regulations when it comes to dress. Do you remember back in the day in the 70s and 80s when that was required here in America? What was that like?
Well, they've tried to implement those types of standards over the years. We tried to implement them on the local level. No one really cares.
Yeah.
Simply because if you've got a t-shirt on and you come in and in the summertime in shorts, a t-shirt and sandals, hey, I'll take an entry fee all day long. And you know what? At the state championships, in local tournaments, the bigger tournaments locally,
mm-hmm.
especially when they're held in non-hotel venues, that is still the standard.
Right.
And you want to walk in with a shirt that, you know, has, you know, a Megadeth on it, or if you want to walk in with a shirt that, you know, says this bud's for you, well, you know, whether it's a beer can or something else, you know, it's going to be accepted.
Yeah.
When you go to venues where you see professional people, world championships, you know, hotel tournaments and that sort of thing, it has been tried.
Yes.
The problem always comes when the promoter wants to liquidate his tournament.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a hard time turning away a guy in a t-shirt with $100 bill.
Right.
Because
right.
he's trying to cover his expenses and run the tournament and make his payout. And I honestly get that. And so that's why it really hasn't gone very far, very fast.
Yeah.
Because there's the same thing at the major tournaments, whether it's run by Charles McIntosh, Mary Moore, Dave Currington, a world championship tour event, or, you know, a local state championship, you know, all of these guys are thanking the good Lord that they're having people walk in the door wanting to play foosball, and it's hard not to turn your face away and let them in whatever they're wearing, as long as it's not too obscene or offensive.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Of course, they've bend the rules a little bit for the girls, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I noticed.
As we always do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is especially because you've got such a mix. You've got, you know, the pro masters,
right.
the pros, the experts, and, of course, the other levels on down. And, you know, amateur players are not there necessarily for the big win. They would certainly hope to be, but oftentimes amateurs there because they just want to have some fun, get together with friends, and have a nice weekend away from home with their foosball compatriots. So, you know, going to the top of the field and dressing like that, well, it's not as much of a concern, especially the way things are structured for American tournaments, it seems.
And that's true, because you've got these lower-rated players and players who are going first time to a tournament And, you know, a lot of them, honestly, there are different classes of foosball players economically.
Yep.
Some of them don't have two nickels to run together and getting their best what they can. Others of them come there flush and they dress nicely.
Yeah.
So you do have that mix. You also have the integration of those younger players wanting to team up with somebody and play an open doubles so they can get a shot at playing a Todd Lacroix or,
right.
you know, a Terry Rue or somebody that, you know, they've only heard about. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, for that, that's the hook that gets them into foosball in the long term. Because I tell you what, when you go to a foosball tournament for the first time, it's like walking into Never Never Land. Wow. I remember my first time at World Championship. It's like, gee, there's 50, 60, 80 tables in this room. Are you kidding me?
Yep.
I mean, I sort of felt that way the first time I walked into the quarterhouse in San Antonio, right outside of San Antonio College. I walk in there and there's 10 foosball tables and people are playing on all of them. And I'm like, I'm in heaven.
Yeah, no. It's and of course as time goes on and you get to see even more tables, it's astounding. I guess there was at one point during the late 70s, early 80s before TS collapsed, there was sometimes 1,000 or more players in a tournament.
That's what I heard. And there have been one or two Tornado World Championships over the years. I've seen the accounts, and you know, big money draws a lot of players.
Yes.
And you know, there was a from foosball came to America in the 60s. Vending companies really took a hold of it. It was the new item on their vending route.
Yes.
And as the 60s came and went, and tournament soccer came and went, one of the detriments that happened was all the tables that came to America in original were not very good on location.
Mm.
The Rene Pierre table, once you bend those telescoping rods, you cannot straighten them.
Uh-huh.
And you know, vendors did not know how to take care of foosball tables, so repair was an issue. Tournament soccer came along, and that table was so inferior in terms of quality that there are stories of 10 and 20 men breaking per night in a hard-played location. And, you know, although I never saw that personally, so, you know, it is hearsay.
Mm-hmm.
But everything I ever heard, a solid rod, and I know this from experience, a solid rod, once it gets bent, can never be perfectly straight.
Wow.
A hollow rod can be perfectly straightened.
Okay.
And so, you know, the heavy rods and a lot of things that were with the tournament soccer table and the vendors really became disenchanted with foosball.
Yeah.
And whether it was a tournament soccer, whether it was a Bonzini, whether or a Rene Pierre, a Deutschmeister, or whatever, vendors just really they went from, oh, this is great, but, oh, you want a foosball table? Well, I best one off and see if I can't get it to you. And it might be 20 years old, but you want a foosball table? Well, that's the best I got.
Wow.
And that, you know, truthfully for us, myself and other vendors across the country, that is what gave us the opportunity.
Yeah.
And because in my area, it was controlled by, for lack of a better word, organized crime.
Oh, okay.
So the same guys that ran the poker games and the other under the table aspects of the entertainment,
mm-hmm.
were the same guys that were running the video games, the pool tables, the jukeboxes in bars and, you know, other venues. And
right.
So when those guys who had all this investment became disenamored with foosball,
mm.
we had an opportunity to move a table into place. And so in my career, I would go to a location, try to land the location, find out that there was a vendor, contact the vendor, and he would tell me that I would have my legs broke if I put a table in. Or he would tell me that, I don't care because I hate foosball, but you better sign a contract with me that you're never going to try to put a jukebox in.
Oh.
Or run me out of my location.
Man.
And so, you know, I've seen it every which way. And fortunately, I was able to land locations and build a route of, you know, a number of tables and have tournament venues at multiple locations in North Carolina.
Okay.
To really begin to make things happen here. But that was an opportunity that came out of the, I'm not going to try to say anything too negative about the early tables because I played on them and I love foosball too and
sure.
love playing on all of them.
Yeah.
But the reality is if they don't make the muster on the commercial side, then they're not going to last long and you're not going to have the location long.
Yeah.
And if you don't maintain those tables, you will not have the location long either. Because the players will come and play them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's what the Tornado brought to the table. The Dynamo table, they first tried to make it a tournament soccer table. That didn't work in the years that we had the Dynamo and Tornado Challenge in the World Championships for 2 years, 86 and 87, is, you know, when the decision was made really by the players, which table do you like? And
mm-hmm.
the first year that Dynamo and Tornado squared off is about equal. Number of participants on each table at dual events. And the next year, 87, it was 3 or 4 to 1 or 5 to 1
oh.
on the Tornado side. And the die was cast. Dynamo decided they were just going to go for making tables for the international market and their distribution network because they still had that and the vendors and such. Tornado was just loving promoters because vendors were pretty much saying, nah, I don't think we're going to buy foosball tables no more. And the vending distributors, they'd buy 10 and they'd hold them and maybe they'd sell 1 or 2 a year, you know, type thing. And, you know, but foosball in the early 80s was rebirthed by a number of us promoters out in the field. And, you know, I can name most all of them.
Okay.
Dave Currington being one of them out in Houston. You had Mike and Kathy Woman, of course, after Gil Jackson died, it was Todd's, partner in 77 when he won his first world title.
Yep.
Will Jackson became a Tornado dealer and was moving Tornado tables up into the Denver area, which was, you know, ground zero of the pro base of TS.
Yes.
And, you know, that's what really began the changeover in the Denver area. And so and then Will died, Mike and Kathy Warman took over the Dynamo, after 97, they pretty much, Kathy Brainerd had moved back up to the Northwest, and mm-hmm. Johnny Lott was no longer involved with Dynamo and all, and they sort of just fell by the wayside, and so that left it open for those of us who were doing Tornado tables to reemerge the sport. And you had guys up in the Northeast like the Banks Brothers, and you know, later guys that promoted Greg Mandel and such, who did great jobs up in that area.
Mm-hmm.
There's Kevin Westcott in the later years. You know, now you still got, you know, the Albany group that sort of keeps things moving in the right direction.
Yeah.
You know, what's down in Georgia? You had Billy and Bobby Griffith who were down there in the 80s. And, you know, they gave way to Richard Hall and Rick Petro and, you know, a number of others that kept it going to this day. And, you know, even the this current generation has reached back to those guys.
Mm-hmm.
And the same with all the guys in Texas. You know, Steve Murray was not always a promoter, but he ended up taking the Texas State Championships. And, boy, he ran with it hard for a lot of years and did a great job down there, as,
yeah.
you know, have the folks out in most other areas, and we've seen it resurge. So I've said for all my career, baseball has survived in spite of, you know,
the challenges,
tables,
yeah,
the challenges, not really because of anybody, but because of, you know, a lot of people just loving the game and continuing to promote it. And I took it on as my goal, in the 80s. And as my career began to develop, to do everything I could to help everybody else do what they need to do.
Yeah.
I mean, I've provided tables for Mary Moore's tournaments for 17 years.
Wow.
Before we parted ways.
That's amazing.
So, yeah. And so, you know, heavily involved in every aspect, but, yeah, good stuff.
As a promoter, did you have certain events that you found more enjoyable? Was there a favorite event in a given year that you always look forward to?
You mean as in a particular tournament?
Yeah, but you know, something that you always wanted to be a part of.
Well, I mean, I was always a part of world championships, but yes. Running it and, you know, tables and stuff like that. My state championship, of course, is always the circle on the calendar because I run it. I ran so many tournaments, it was hard to have just a star on any of them. The Bardo
yes.
was an awful lot of fun to run. Being involved in Colorado State Championship, boy, I love the promoters out there, love the players out there. Texas, kind of my second home. Started my first route in San Antonio when I was in college.
Yeah.
You know, I have been involved in so many tournaments in Texas, from the Texas State Championships, Bardo, the Worlds every year when it's down there. So, it's really not a target. I love going overseas and playing.
Mm-hmm.
But, that was a different experience. My target was the next tournament. All of my career, I ran three to four tournaments a week.
A week?
In local tournaments, in the 80s and 90s.
Wow.
And in later years, I just farmed that out to other people who run the tournaments for me in those areas that still did all the work and maintenance and all that. But, you know, we'd run three, four tournaments a week.
Wow.
And then I would run, one year I ran 18 different events on weekends.
Huh.
So that's more than one a month.
Yeah.
And of course, in latter years, my last 10 years, that began to dwindle a little bit for a variety of reasons. But in any case, never was there one tournament. I mean, I guess Worlds is the one you're always kind of looking forward to because it is World Championship.
Yes.
But, my state championships would probably be the two that I targeted. But, man, I tell you what, a lot of work goes into every one of them, whether you're taking tables to Nebraska or California or Florida or wherever it is.
Mm-hmm.
We had a box truck. We'd go about anywhere.
You just got to get them there any way you can. I mean, I appreciate what you guys go through. I know I was talking to Mary Moore about one of her events last year where her trailer, the whole transport, the tires came off in the middle of her trip. And I can't imagine, being stranded with a whole bunch of tables and a trailer, and then all of a sudden the tires come off. That's got to be a real, you got to be dedicated to get yourself there. I think she was going out to Vegas, in fact, at the time. But, when it comes to your experience as a promoter, what was the most fun you can think of in one particular time? What can you tell us about why it was so much fun and why you remember it?
Well, the thing whenever we provide tables for a tournament, whether it would be here locally in a state championship or some other venue in some other state, the work begins a couple of weeks before.
Mm-hmm.
You got to arrange everything. And, of course, the excitement is all about when you get there, you meet the tables, you unbox them, you do everything a couple of days, a day or two beforehand.
Yep.
To get the venue perfectly ready. And that was always my goal. I want it perfectly ready. All the tables lighted, all the tables lubricated, all the tables leveled, all the tables strategically positioned to make the room flow.
Mm-hmm.
That was something I was very good at is design. Steve Murray used to say, "Hey Charlie, design the room, I'm a leaf." And that's what we would do. And the traffic patterns are so important.
Yeah.
To make everybody's job as a player easy to get to. Nothing in their way, those sorts of things, not griping about the table condition. And so those are things that we really look forward to. And, of course, at the end of the tournament, you've played all weekend, you've promoted all weekend. With me, it's always 1,000 questions. People wanting to buy a table after the tournament. People wanting to buy a part right now.
Yes.
I need a wrap because I got a match in 10 minutes, whatever it might be. Of course, we ran booths, we sold merchandise and that sort of thing. So, it was an absolute, from the beginning to the end, it was just a race.
Yeah.
And you're in it, and it's all of a sudden it's over, and you're tearing down tables. And when you get home and you start taking everything apart, you really get to reflect and think about how things went. And fortunately, in my career, everything went pretty good.
Okay.
We had a couple of times we had some pretty pretty tight issues. Bardo 1 year, the Tables, the trucking company, or not the Tables, were all there. And the ride actually picked them up from the factory and drove them down from Dallas, or from Fort Worth.
Oh, boy.
And but the lights were still on a truck.
Oh.
And they had been sent 7 days earlier from North Carolina, and for some snafu, they got left somewhere. They hotted them to us. We got those lights, I think, on around noon or 1 o'clock the day of the event.
Oh.
So we had 5 hours to put lights over all of the tables. We managed to do it.
Yeah. where there's a will.
My worst time was in Nebraska. I flew into Denver, rented the car, drove over to Grand Island, Nebraska, where the tournament was, to meet the tables, and the lights were on the same truck. They were still in Kansas City.
Oh.
The tables were. And this was the day before the tournament.
Oh, man.
I was driving down there. Yeah. I had to get with FedEx. We had sent the tables 2 weeks before to make sure
we
schedule the delivery on that day. And somehow they had gotten left in Kansas City.
Man.
And so I ended up, that was the worst tournament financially for me. Because I had to pay $1,800 to get tables driven however far it was from Kansas City to Grand Island.
Oh.
And the tables got there, I believe it was like around noon on Friday, and the tournament started Friday night.
Oh, no kidding. Oh, man.
Guess what? We had the tables ready.
You
did. We had lights on them, and we started all the events on time. Yes, sir, we did.
Wow.
And the guy looks at me and says, there's no way I can afford that. I said, don't worry about it. It's my problem.
Okay.
It's my expense.
Okay.
It's not yours. And, boy, you've never seen a guy just be so thankful, because it was a really rough trip. And sometimes you just got to eat it. And that day I did. And you know what? We had a great time and a great tournament. And I love Nebraska. You got to do two of them.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Yep.
Well, you know what? When life gives you lemons, you make lemons.
That's right. Hey, man, just make the best of the most. If you don't make the best of a bad situation, I don't know if you can enjoy a better situation.
Yeah, exactly.
Really.
Yeah, you know, you gotta learn to appreciate what you do when it works. Hey, you know, that's gravy. That's great. And
I'm gonna tell you something else. This is an aside. I want to give a shout out to every person, and there's hundreds of them out there. And on this radio show, I want to do a shout out to every single person that ever helped me put a table together, ever helped me tear a table down, ever helped me in any way with a foosball tournament. I thank all of you out there, and I'm so thankful to you, and I think of you by name almost every day. Some new person I remember that worked hard at a tournament, and yes, talk about great camaraderie.
Yes.
That was really the best.
Yeah, and being in the trenches together, it forms a family. You know, you're working towards the same goal and working side by side and making it happen. That's amazing.
Yep. Yep.
So the other thing that I wanted to chat with you about, there's some more recent changes happening in some of the tournament formats. And I know we've been experimenting a bit with local. We have a monster DYP in our local venue. Mm-hmm. But now there's a trend towards this thing called championship play for the open events and some of the bigger venues. Championship, of course, if you're in the open and you lose a match, you end up in the loser's bracket. But the best you can do is third place. As a player, as a promoter, what do you think about that kind of a format?
You know, I haven't been exposed to it. As a promoter, the double elimination format has been a pox on foosball, and a necessary pox, because it does keep people playing. It's not a one and done and you're gone. It has been an incentive all throughout the 50 the years that we've been using that format to basically keep people involved and keep them in the room. And I get that. Change is hard for anybody. And we have to change to something that is a little bit more fair and balanced and can work within time constraints. That's something Fareed worked really hard to accomplish over with the ITSF. And he should be applauded for that.
Yeah.
I don't know if that format is the one that it certainly isn't the one that I would choose.
Okay.
I actually invented a format which was a really good format back in the I believe it was in the 2000 the first decade of 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And it involved qualifiers and you know, the qualifier system. I could go into it in some detail.
Sure.
But that particular format involved two qualifiers for every event.
Okay.
And you would have the top four qualifiers in that event advance to the finals bracket on Sunday.
Okay.
And it would basically be an 18 chart on Sunday that would be playoffed. And so if you had for instance, in a qualifier, 64 teams playing to 32 to 16 to 8 to 4, there's only four matches.
Yeah.
For each team. And so what we did was, and we ran this format at our state championship, and I was out of the room every night before midnight.
Wow.
And all of them were complete. And so what that format did was, it allowed a person to enter the first qualifier on one day, say open doubles.
Okay.
And he finishes in the top four. He doesn't play again until Sunday in open doubles.
Wow.
Singles events, I think, were the next day. And so Terry Moore, I remember Terry, specifically came to that event. And I asked him, I said, Terry, what do you think about this format? He said, I think it's great. He qualified for open singles and open doubles and mixed doubles, his three events. And I think he also, I don't know if he played, no, I don't, he may have qualified also in limited.
Okay.
For the pro-am, or it was limited for us, it wouldn't have been a pro-am. But anyway, he qualified for all those and basically had Saturday off.
Hmm. Wow.
And Sunday he came back and played all his matches, and Terry pretty much won everything.
Of course.
but in any case, what it did was, you were in your event and you played your matches one right after the other as soon as the other team was finished.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you were in a bracket, you played your match and you're waiting on the other match to finish so it could be called right now.
Wow.
And so you played one right after the other until you were either eliminated or you were continuing to play out to the final four.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. And we did two of those qualifiers, one qualifier one day, the next qualifier the next day. And so come Sunday, you couldn't enter two qualifiers. You know, you couldn't win one qualify in one, and you couldn't play for the next one.
Mm-hmm.
So the top four teams were already backed out. Terry Moore would be playing in your next qualifier. So you had a better chance to get to the final four.
Yes.
Right? As long as, theoretically, the top four teams probably qualified that first day.
Yeah.
And so the next day, boy, everybody's got a better chance. Boy, that would fit, that filled it up. And so we did that in every single event.
Huh.
Even the DYP. Only DYP, it went down to the final two.
Jeez.
So you had a 14 bracket for the specialty events. You had an 18 bracket for the major events.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that gave us a better ability to schedule things with those limited amounts. People could schedule their time. Because you could say, hey, I'm gonna try to qualify in open doubles, and it starts at 11 a.m. So you go in, you sign up for open doubles, you get put out in one straight, and you go, well, that's fine. I don't have to wait. I'm going to go eat lunch.
Yeah.
I'm gonna choose another qualifier in an hour and a half. I'm going to try to play an expert singles or whatever.
Yes.
And, you know, you could schedule your time. You know, if you didn't want to play, just didn't sign up. But
okay.
If you played, you were playing one right after the other until you were eliminated or qualified then you're done with that.
See, I like that.
You can go do what you want the rest of the day. You can go to a movie.
Yeah.
And that's what Terry Moore did.
Yeah.
He went to a movie on Saturday and had a good time and came back and partied and played pickup games with people. It was wonderful.
Yeah.
And, you know, that sort of format could absolutely work. But it ran afoul of certain promoters.
Okay.
Mary Moore in particular, because it didn't fit what she thought would work. And so it got a lot of blowback, and I just let it go. But the Swiss system, I think, is far too complicated for people to really get into and figure out.
Okay.
And so that one of the reasons I don't particularly care for it, the system of once you lose, you don't have a chance to win the tournament. That is a real negative for, you know, the format you just described.
Yeah.
And for that reason, I don't particularly like it. And in a sense, it's trying to have the best of both worlds.
Right.
The best of both worlds, meaning you still got a double elimination tournament. You still got that bracket still having to play out. You got the open bracket playing out. And I like the part that they don't have to play anymore. You know, and they're playing sort of a single elimination format once they get so far out. I get that. And that's good. But, you know, in terms of scheduling people's time, it's no better for them.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're still playing multiple events at the same time. The rule that we had for my format was, if you're going to enter a qualifier event, you can't enter any other qualifier event until you're out. And, you know, for an amateur that wants to play in open doubles, will enter open doubles, get put out the first round, and an hour later he can enter amateur doubles.
Yes, right.
But if he wins his first two matches and is still in open doubles, an hour later when amateur doubles starts, he don't get in it.
Yeah, okay. So no complex.
But he can play in the qualifier the next day for amateur doubles because there are two of them.
Okay.
And not only that, there's another little add-in that if you played in the first qualifier with, let's say you and I played in the first qualifier and I couldn't block nothing or I couldn't score nothing if I was up front. And you say, man, that Charles is just a dog. I ain't playing this play with him again. You could go pick up, you know, somebody even better and play with them in the second qualifier.
Okay.
You weren't locked in to your only partner.
Right.
Now, you could buy a package to allow you to play in anything, you know, and so you could, you know, sort of had options as you could massage yourself through that tournament.
So the players, no matter what your rank, you still get your money's worth for the weekend.
Right, and I had guys, I literally had players who had to work on one day and could not make the first qualifier.
Okay.
But they showed up for the second one because they had to work the first day, or their partner couldn't be there that day, or their partner was playing somebody else, and then you got, he lost, and he won't play with him anymore, so he picked up a new one. So, you know, we had it all worked all the different ways. And, you know, scheduling the finals at the end of the tournament is the key to keeping that format, you know, nice and tidy.
Yeah.
We managed to do that, and we had everything done before dark.
Well, you know, that kind of an idea, that format, sounds to me like it's much more media-friendly. You know, when you've got coverage, you've got people like Jim Stevens who are covering these matches. He knows his schedule. He knows when he's going to be calling the majors. And it's a win-win in that regard.
Right. 100%.
Yeah. Wow. Well, there is a lot of talk about unifying and trying to come up with some kind of a, I guess you'd say, a federation, as in like the USTSO, and try to unify all the major tour stops. And it's a work in progress, obviously, and everybody's trying to, I guess, pull on the same end of the rope. But, you know, we're human beings, and everything doesn't necessarily work out the way you want it to as quickly as you'd like it to. But let's hope that your idea or your format can come back and make another showing.
I'm not going to hold my breath waiting for a phone call on that. And for probably pretty good reasons, a number of reasons that we won't go into here.
Mm-hmm.
But it's high time that foosball became more streamlined.
Yes.
And more user-friendly. And it has to become media-friendly if it's ever going to go anywhere.
Agreed.
And it's my wife who has worked with me for all my years, all these years. We got married in 88, so we're on year 36 now.
Mm-hmm.
And in all those years, she's always told me, she says, until these football players start acting professionally, dressing professionally, and present a professional image, and these tournaments become streamlined to the point to where you can schedule times for events,
yes,
media, and that sort of thing, it's not really going to go anywhere.
Yeah.
And she was so right. Foosball has been, as I said, has survived in spite of the people and formats and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the greatness of the game will endures. It doesn't matter who we lose. You know, I mean, I'm gone now. Guess what? It continues. Nobody is an island.
Yes.
And hopefully we'll be able to see this thing move forward. I'm really thankful for the opportunity that I had to have a role in keeping it going for 40 years and to help the promoters that I did. And I tell you what, I look back and it's kind of a, I'm proud in a way that I had an opportunity to keep it going.
Yes.
But I'm sad that it never made it further than it did.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's promoters across the country. It was always my dream to have, when I started TornadoFoosball.com, it was my goal to give all the promoters and distributors, or all the promoters across the country, the asset that they needed in terms of tables provided for their events,
mm-hmm,
the cheapest parts and that they could find anywhere, and to help them help themselves to promote the sport in their area. Because
mm-hmm,
I can't go promote in Nebraska. I can go provide tables for a tournament in Nebraska, but I'm not the guy on the ground in Nebraska.
Exactly.
Neither am I the guy on the ground in Kentucky or Florida or any of the other venues that I went to provide tables for. My name doesn't bring people to tournaments.
Yeah.
Good. It may help because they know they're going to have some good equipment there. But the people on the ground are the ones that do that. And my experience with promoters across the country,
mm-hmm,
it's kind of like herding cats.
Yeah.
They've all got their own way they want to do it.
Yeah.
They all are independent. And here's the really hard thing to for a lot of people to square. Hardly any of them do it for a living.
Right.
They do it because they love the sport.
Yeah. I mean,
and the problem with that is people that do not do it for a living do something else for a living, and they do this for part-time.
Right.
And that's why you see promoters coming and going. Because I'm going to tell you what, promoting is not an easy job.
Yep.
It's not fun to have to make a ruling that fires somebody up on one side of the table and makes somebody happy on the other side of the table, even though the ruling may be as fair as it can possibly be.
Yep.
And so you just have so many attendant issues and people's energy levels and, most people have very little skin in the game.
Mm-hmm.
With me, everything I did in my football career, I was 100% all in.
Mm-hmm.
All of my investment dollars, all of my work, all of everything. I gave everything I did to the sport. And so when I walked away, it was a relief to not have those responsibilities anymore.
Yeah.
And, it was time. And so I'm enjoying my time on the golf course.
I can imagine, yes. And I know you're up against a time restraint here today, but I got to say, Charles, first of all, on behalf of myself and everybody who listens to this show and people that love the sport, thank you so much for what you've done and the things, the hard work you've put in. You deserve kudos, more than just a place in the Hall of Fame, which, of course, is a great thing. But you deserve so much more than that, and we really appreciate all your efforts.
Well, I'll tell you this. I told my financial advisor about 6 months ago, I said, it's a miracle I could retire at all.
Yeah.
But this is the life that foosball built.
Yes.
I mean, I didn't do anything else for a living. I think I helped Brendan open a golf course once for about 3 months and a number of years ago. And, I did some part-time work other ways. But all of my career has been nothing but foosball.
Yeah.
And I look at it, and I'm pretty proud of what was accomplished. Would have liked to have done more. Would have liked to have seen it gone further. you know, some of the relationships that that didn't go so well are difficult. But overall, very happy, very happy, and thank you for the kind words.
Oh,
I did the best I could. I always did the best I could for everybody I worked with and worked for. And as a player, I played hard every time I could. I was never the best player in any room I ever walked into, except maybe doing a DYP in a local haunt or whatever.
Sure.
You know, me, I was just a guy that, you know, lived the dream and loved playing the game. And, you know, I didn't mind working for it.
And that's, you know what it is? It's its own satisfaction because, you know, just to get out for a DYP, I know, just speaking from personal experience, getting out to play the DYP, and we do it on Friday nights, I look forward to that time of the week. It's like, that's what I'm working towards. That's what I'm looking forward to. And when I'm there, nothing else matters.
Well, I'll tell you what, night before last, I went down and helped a buddy of mine move a foosball table out of his basement to his new house.
Okay.
And we went from there to the local tournament down in Charlotte. On the tables now that I sold to, you know, a local player who now, Jason McCall and his wife, Michelle, who have run our state championships for the last 5 or 6 years or 8 years. And since I gave it up. But I provided tables for all their events up until the time I retired. And, boy, it was nice to walk in that room, see them, see all the other folks, and everybody I know. I mean, it's like old home week. And I go by a local tournament about once every 3 or 4 months just to see the old, see my old friends.
Yes.
It is absolutely wonderful. And they beg me, and they beg me to play. And you know what I tell them? It's better to be a has-been than it never was. And now, if I play 5 or 6 games, I'll play as good as I ever played.
Good.
But after that, the arm just doesn't place the ball on the goal like it should, whether I'm playing back or front.
Yeah.
I just cannot shoot the ball with any degree of efficiency or effectiveness.
Yeah.
And so I'm not going to drag people down. So I'll go in, and maybe every now and then I'll play a pickup game or something like that, just for grins. I did play in a tournament last year, and the same thing happened. You know, it doesn't matter who I play with. If I'm 2 matches up in the winner's bracket and then the arm goes, it's like, man, you might as well shoot me. You know?
Well, it is, it's an endurance. It's an endurance race. It's not something you just, you know, you just can't expect to win if you're running out of energy. But hey, you know what? I think we're of similar age. I'm in my 60s. And you know what? If I can still stand up and play, it doesn't matter. You know, I'm not going to be going for the big prize or the big open title or anything like that. But, you know, I just want to improve my game each time and play. But you know what? It's still something that we're passionate about. So we're not going to worry whether or not you have the energy at the end. We're not going to worry about that.
Yeah, I get it, but I do have my own standards. I mean, I at least want to be competitive, and I don't like to be an anchor and drag somebody down. And I tell people now that, you know, in the foosball world, if I play one match, I may shoot the ball 40 times in one match, in one game even. And, you know, I just can't shoot. I don't have any more than 40, 50, 60 shots in me.
Yes.
You know, until things go south. But I can go on a golf course. I'll hit the ball hard about 40, 45 times. And then putting is really easy. I mean, no stress for that. And so I'll put the ball about another 20, 30 times and, you know, go home shooting somewhere near par. I can still play to the level because I get rest between shots.
Right, right, exactly.
Hop in the cart, ride 100 yards, and then you get to it again. So, you know, I can hit the ball 40 times like that and, have a good time, go home and sleep good, and not have to wake up the next morning for a 2:30, you know, a 7:30 match.
Yeah, right. You know, somebody once said that playing golf is a great way to ruin an otherwise great walk. But if you're riding a cart, what's the difference, right?
fair, you know. When you get older, it's nice to ride where you're going. You get your exercise by walking back and forth through the ball.
Well, we certainly hope you hit him straight, and we're looking forward to the future because here's the thing. The door is wide open. I want to talk to you again. I'd love to get some stories from the past when we have more time.
Okay, sounds good.
Yeah. So, Charles McIntosh, thank you so much for making episode 200 of Foos Talk Live so memorable and such a great experience. Just catching up with all your knowledge and, of course, the things you've done. But thank you so much for being with us on this episode.
Well, it's been my pleasure to speak with you, Tom, and it's been my privilege to serve the foosball community all of my career, and I look back at it with fondness and sense of satisfaction, and I still check the charts to see how the local guys do and all my friends across the country. So I'm looking in, even though we're not, at those big events. So thanks again for the opportunity to share a little bit of it, and I look forward to talking to you again maybe one day.
It's our pleasure, and we're looking forward to our next conversation.
All right, my friend. You have a good one, and thanks again.
You bet.
Foosball tournaments are everywhere. Foos Talk Live proudly presents a weekly update of events near you with the Foos Talk Live Tournament Beat. Here's what's up. It's the 2024 Wisconsin State Championship, set for March 21st through the 24th at the Clarion Hotel in Appleton, Wisconsin. It's the Utah Foosball Bash, March 22nd through 24th at Murray Eagles, Salt Lake City, Utah. 518 Foosball presents the Mad March Smashdown, March 30th at Trickshots Billiards and Wicked Eatery, Clifton Park, New York. Two Gun Productions presents the 2024 Oklahoma State Championship, April 4th through the 7th at Magoo's in Tulsa, Oklahoma. The 2024 Canadian Foosball Tour continues with the Canadian Hall of Fame Open, April 5th through the 7th. Tailgaters Sports, Entertainment and Food, Ottawa, Canada. Event Sports Grill presents the Hall of Fame Warm-Up, Saturday, April 6th at Event Sports Grill, Riverside, California. International Foosball Promotions presents the 2024 Hall of Fame Classic, April 17th through the 21st at the Westgate Resort and Casino in Las Vegas, Nevada. It's the $10,500 2024 Minnesota State Championships, May 3rd through the 5th at the American, Ham Lake, Minnesota. PDX Foosball presents Moneyball 2024. That's May 9th through the 12th at the Crown Plaza Hotel in Portland, Oregon. The ITSF proudly presents the World Series of Tornado 2024, May 24th through the 27th at the Westin Dallas-Fort Worth Airport, Dallas, Texas. Powder your balls. Here comes the Romp in the Swamp Florida Foosball Tour Part 2. June 1st and 2nd at Qforia Winter Park, Orlando, Florida. The 2024 Illinois State Championships, June 7th through the 9th. Poplar Creek Bowl, Hoffman Estates, Illinois. International Foosball Promotions presents the 2024 National Championships and North American Cup, June 27th through the 30th at the Clarion Hotel in Kenner, New Orleans, Louisiana. The 2024 Tornado Championships, officially on August 28th through September 2nd at the Clarion Hotel in Lexington, Kentucky. The 2024 Florida State Championship and Masters Open, coming up September 26th through the 29th at Holiday Inn in Clearwater, Florida. Mark your calendar for the 2024 Michigan State Championships, October 11th through the 13th in Lansing, Michigan. More details coming soon. Two Gun Productions present the 2024 Halloween Open, October 31st through November 3rd at Magoo's in Tulsa, Oklahoma. It's the 2024 North Carolina State Championships, November 28th through December 1st at the Crown Plaza in Asheville, North Carolina. Each week, we do our best to give you the most up-to-date listing of foosball tournaments near you. If you have an event you'd like to add, send us all the details at info@foosballradio.com. Tune in every week for the Foos Talk Live Tournament Beat. Foos Talk Live is a product of Foosball Radio. With gratitude, we recognize our Foosball Radio Patreons, our Foos Talk Live sponsor,
original-leonhardt-usa.com. And thanks to InsideFooze.com for use of their audio during the show.
Tune in again next week for another episode of Foos Talk Live.
In the meantime,
we'll see you foozin'.